All right. The next two words I'm going to say, Matt Brynjolfsson says they're the best words in beer to get people's attention. Vinny Chalurzo. Yeah. I'll tell you, it works every time. Just walk into a crowded, noisy room full of brewers and say that, and everybody looks over, shuts up. But we've got more than Vinny up here. We've got a great panel for you today where you're going to learn about a new experimental hop. I just actually smelled it, and I think you guys are going to love this. It's amazing. But, of course, we got Vinny Chalurzo from Russian River Brewing Company up here. Vinny's, as you know, a fantastic brewer, but he's also a good friend to brewers. He loves to talk about beer. He's like a brewer's brewer. So don't ever be shy around Vinny. If you've got beer questions, he likes to talk about beer. Come on up and ask him. So maybe after the panel, if we don't get to everybody's questions, you can talk to these guys. We also have Carl Van Evenhoven here. He's from Yakima Chief Hop Union. And, yeah. Carl knows what he's doing. Graduate of Purdue University, and he's got a degree in chemical engineering, and he's a badass up at Yakima, so you're going to learn a lot from him today. And then Jason Peralt from Hop Breeding Company and Peralt's Farms. Yeah. Jason's a fourth-generation hop grower. This kid grew up on a farm, on a hop farm, which is kind of a dream come true. So he really knows what he's doing, too, and he's going to talk about this new hop variety with you. So without further ado, let's get to it, guys. Enjoy.
Hey, everyone. How's it going? Thanks for coming to our talk today. We appreciate it. Just a quick rundown before Jason gets up and starts. We're going to start with Jason. He's going to talk a little bit about hop breeding in general and then specifically about the HBC 438, the experimental hop that is in the Ron Mexico commemorative beer. Ron Mexico is also the alias for the 438, so you'll hear us bouncing back and forth between 438 and Ron Mexico. So we're talking about the beer name and the hop itself. After Jason, we're gonna get Carl up here. You'll get a lot of information on breeding from Jason. Carl's going to tell a lot of the story, kind of how this hop came to be, and then I'll close things out talking about brewing with single hops, and then specifically the Ron Mexico commemorative beer. We'll have the recipe up on the board. Don't feel like you need to jot it down. I'm sure Brewers Association will get it up on their website, and my email's up there as well. I can just email it to you. Jason, ready?
Thank you, Vinny. Thank you, everyone, for showing up, and good afternoon. I've been out here one night, and things were already hazy a little bit, so.
That was my fault.
That was his fault. Blame him. But as Vinny said, we're going to be talking about this new hop variety, but we also wanted to make it an educational presentation as well, and since you guys had some takeaways and maybe know a little bit more about hops than you did when you came in. So with that, I'm going to be talking about some basic hop info, the impact of the hop variety on its overall impact on the hop supply chain, and then why we undertake variety development efforts. And then I'll move into talking specifically about HBC 438. So I'm going to move through a lot of information relatively quick because we don't have a lot of time. So I'll be happy to answer questions afterwards, and feel free to track me down.
Sorry, that's just in the back.
Okay. There you go. Is that better? All right. So feel free to track me down. I can answer any questions that you might have, and I'll be around tonight as well. So I'll go back up to that slide. So hops are dioecious. That means they're separate male and female plants. That makes them very genetically complex. The males have no commercial value. It's actually the females we're interested in commercial production. So all those cones that you're using in making beer and all the plants you see out in the field are actually the female portions of the plant and the female plants themselves. They're annual above ground and perennial below ground. This allows for clonal propagation, and they are climbing vine requiring a support system. So So we have these big 18-foot trellises throughout the growing areas. So there's a lot of infrastructure that grows in the growing hops. It's not a crop you just jump right into. And they are photoperiod sensitive, which means they require specific day lengths to flower, which is why you find hops in very specific areas of the world, usually around the 45th parallel. And that's why it's also difficult to get a crop in other areas. So the combination of that needed infrastructure for growing them and the photoperiod issue really limits hop production, making it a very specialized crop. So these are just some pictures of the, you can see the cones on the left there, and then the male flowers on the right. You can see there's huge morphological differences there. And so that's why we're not interested in the males from a commercial standpoint. And in fact, we try to get rid of them because the males are contribute to creating seed in the hop cones, and we don't want that. So to understand why we breed hops, it's kind of important to know that kind of development of the hop plant itself. It goes through numerous stages of growth throughout the year, and each stage has its own unique characteristics. These stages of growth include dormancy during the wintertime, spring regrowth, which you can kind of see down, you can see the twining picture up there where we're getting just started, vegetative growth period, that's what we're in right now, and then you go into a reproductive stage where we're producing cones in the crop itself. And then at harvest, we're going into a preparation for dormancy where that plant is taking all the energy from the sun and putting it down into the roots. So it's all these stages have to really be understood if you're going to successfully manage the crop. So here's some pictures. You can just see the bottom. On the bottom left there is a picture of a plant as it's emerging in the spring. And just prior to that, we're twining, which is the top picture. And this is a fascinating process. These guys are actually very skilled at what they do. They're going through and tying knots with one hand as that twining sled moves through the field. It's very difficult, and it's not something I even do. And then you can kind of see the pictures there as the crop grows, and the final one on the bottom right is the full vine on that 18-foot trellis I mentioned. So it's important to note that yield has already been determined as early as April and May. And then to complicate this further, much of this is variety dependent. So even now, when that plant's not even halfway to the wire or halfway to the wire, yield's already being determined. So we've got to make sure we're taking care of that plant and understand it. So the variety comes into play in the fact that what we're really trying to realize is the maximum genetic potential of that plant out in the field. But we can't realistically maximize that genetic potential in all environments. So the solution to that problem then is to breed for the traits that we're interested in. So we want to match the environment and meet the industry needs. So we base our objectives on all stakeholders in the industry. We want to provide brewers, you guys, with hops and hop products that enhance your brews, making better beer, hopefully. And then we want to make sure that we key in on the fact that performance of that variety at every level of the industry is going to add to the overall health of the industry. In terms of hop breeding specifically, and this is one of the reasons I wanted to bring this up, is this specific slide here is from the standpoint that it takes 10 years to develop a hop variety. So even though we may be talking about a new hop variety now, the development of this variety started over 10 years ago now. So it's not just a flip of the switch or just you think of something you might want and you have it. It's a long process that goes into it. So we start with parental selection and crossing, go into some early selection stages, and then we go to a 3-year intermediate selection stage, and then a 3-year advanced selection stage. All the while, each stage, we're narrowing that gene pool down to where we might end up with only one at the end if we're lucky. We go into elite trials, which are generally about 1 acre plots, and there again we're about 3 years. So that's where your 10 years comes from. You're crossing 3 years at each stage of the program, and then in year 11 you're looking at commercialization. So it's a very involved process. I won't spend a lot of time here because you probably can't see it real well anyways, but it's just talking about population dynamics. We might start with 40,000 seedlings and end up, if we're lucky, with one. So it's always, my predecessor Chuck used to always tell me that I'm going to find breeding to be a very depressing job. And I didn't really understand what he was saying because, you know, I was excited to be working with him. I was excited to be working in hops. And I loved what I did. But as I've gone on, I've realized what he means, because you get so excited about certain things. And 99 percent chance that it's going to have something wrong with it and you're going to get rid of it. So you start with that 40,000 and you're going to, just through kind of a forced eugenics program, get rid of 99.9% of them. So just some pictures to kind of show what the process looks like out in the field. This is a picture of crossing, so you can see we have different ways of collecting pollen, but we'll actually go out into a nursery where we have just males growing and collect pollen from those males, and then we could store that in cold for a period of time so that we can apply it when the females become receptive, because they're only receptive at certain periods. So then we'll put a big candy wrapper-looking bag over the vines and blow that pollen in there, and we do that to keep other pollen from coming in and potentially contaminating that. So we want to exclude those flowers from being pollinated elsewhere. So, yeah, you know, when we go from those crosses, we'll go to the seedling stage. We typically start with 20 to 50,000 genotypes, and then through greenhouse screening for disease and field screening for disease, we get rid of probably 80 to 90% of that in year one. We're trying to, it's a concept we call fail fast. If it's going to fail, we want to get it out of there as quickly as possible. It's very labor intensive. You can see these are the seedlings planted about 10 inches apart or so, and we got to, in order to get them up to flower, we got to clip all the axillary buds down at the bottom to keep apical dominance in that growing tip. And so each one of those, if it's 20,000 seedlings, each one of them, that kind of care has to be given to each one. These are just some additional pictures showing planting. The vine and the finished vine up there in the top right, and then I talked about receptive females. This is what the cones look like when they're receptive to pollen. So that's what we just call the bloom stage. So after year 11, we're looking at potential for release of that variety commercially. But really, at this stage, it's just another process that starts, and we're far from success yet. And it really depends more on continued agronomic success, which equates to grower acceptance, which is pretty easy. If it yields well, growers want to grow it. But we also have to have brewer acceptance, and this is where it gets a little trickier. It's got to make good beer. There's certain varieties, such as a super alpha variety, that maybe all you're looking for is a lot of alpha. But for aroma hops especially, it's very difficult to find hops that are truly unique and truly add value. So normally we do this through testing with like Vinny. We'll send him hops and he'll brew up some small batches, or at least do rub and sniff and kind of give us an idea if there's interest. But occasionally we homebrew it. And over the years I've given several hops to Carl. We have a little homebrew system at our place as well. But I'll give hops to someone like Carl and say, what do you think? And there's been several occasions. Mosaic's a good example. The first beer we ever had with Mosaic was a homebrew that Carl had made. The next beer I had that made with Mosaic was one that Vinny had made. So it's kind of a really nice process that we have to get this feedback loop closed and allow us to make some decisions. But it gave us an idea. If we're getting these great results from homebrewers and we get a lot of support and a lot of energy from you guys, why not utilize that and give you guys a hop to test before the commercial brewers are able to get in and test it? So we decided we needed the right hop to do that. And that hop would be something that would be unique, that we have some critical volumes of, and that looks like it's going to perform well and that we're very confident about. And HBC 438 really fits that bill. So it's had great performance in 1-acre trials. It looks like it's going to yield well. And we've had several batches of homebrew over the year made by Carl that point out to us that it makes amazing beer. And I think you'll find that we're going to be pouring some here, and I think you'll agree. It's exceptionally unique. I'll talk a little bit more of the actual attributes. But it is an exceptionally unique aroma that adds flavor into beer that I've never experienced myself. And the hop has a great story. And I think that's important. If you're going to release a hop, you should have a good story with that hop. I mean, we're very passionate about what we do, and every hop to me has a story, but I want that story to be relatable to everyone else as well. So some stats: it is a higher alpha hop. We've seen it as high as 18% alpha, which means you're not going to need a lot of it in the kettle. It's got a beta of 6 to 7%, a cohumulon of 20 to 25%. So that's a pretty good level of cohumulon, depending on your philosophy on cohumulon, but we won't get into that discussion. And it's got high oil. I think this is possibly this is really one of the contributing factors to its uniqueness is that 2.5 to seen it as high as 3.5% oil. So that's pretty exceptional. So that gives it a very exceptionally unique aroma. It's got stone fruit, tropical fruit, kind of orange rind. At times I'm reminded of like smelling an Orange Julius. At other times, you get a real herbal minty character from it. So it's very dynamic, very complex, and I think you guys could have a lot of fun with it. And Carl will talk more specifically about the results he gets from brewing. So a little bit of history, where did this variety come from? I said it had a great story. Well, my predecessor was Chuck Zimmerman, and if you've done any research on hop varieties, you'll know that Chuck is pretty much preeminent. I mean, he's everywhere. He was involved in Cascade, Centennial, Simcoe, Palisade, Warrior. You could keep going down a list of all the major varieties that are out there, and it seems like Chuck, in one way or another, was involved. He was a very dynamic person, very great man to work with, and so I was honored to have him as a mentor. So he gave me a plant back around 1997. That's around the time I started taking over the program from him, and he gave me all this germplasm, and there was one in particular that was just this rank, wild, but beautiful plant. The leaves were very much, looked almost like marijuana leaves, but the plant was just this massive rank thing that didn't flower until late into August, if it flowered at all. So it was just an amazing plant. I'd never seen anything like it. It became kind of notorious in the plots just because of this vigorous growth. We had to kind of keep it separate from the rest of the plants because it would overtake everything it was around. And so my assistant breeder at the time, Marco Ramos, nicknamed it Chuck's Mexican. And there's a reason for that, because it was a wild hop plant of the taxonomic variety of Neo Mexicanus, which there's several wild plant taxonomic varieties throughout the world, and we have 2 to 3 of them, depending on who you talk to, in the United States. One of them primarily is Neo Mexicanus, the other being Lupuloides, and more in the Midwest and Upper Midwest. But so that's where the nickname came from. So this is that picture there was Chuck and I years ago, and then this one is Marco. And we had, in 2004, we had some leftover pollen from crossing, and all the females were done. They were past receptiveness, so we took that pollen, and Marco just kind of let it wind pollinate just by spreading the pollen around the outside perimeter of the plant. So we didn't know the father, because what we did is we mixed that pollen together. It was kind of an old trick of Chuck's to get good variable results, was to just let things open pollinate with selected males and get a ton of seed from that. And you can't argue with the results. It works. And, he gets a lot of variation that way. So given the fact that it was a wild plant and we didn't know the father, the outcome was really unpredictable. We didn't know what to expect. 2007, we found a really unique plant. I found it out in the field. In my notes, I think I said it was fruity, aroma, bananas. So it had just something that we don't normally see. And so I'd been talking to Carl about the need to homebrew, or he was talking to me about the need to homebrew some interesting hops, and so I immediately called him that day and said, I think I got something for you. So him and Derry came out. Derry's out here. I'll let Carl introduce him. But they came back for more in 2008, and they asked me what they could call it. And I said, well, it's number 04063630074. Yeah, that's not that sexy at all. So we were trying to think of something to call it, and I told him the nickname of the mother is Chuck's Mexican, and there was some other things going on in the news at the time, and so Derry pipes up and says, let's call it Ron Mexico. So that's kind of where that all came from. So that's kind of my spiel on hop breeding itself, and then the history of HBC 438, and I'll let Carl talk about the brewing.
Yeah. All right, thanks, Jason. I think Jason might have the best title out there, head breeder. Pretty good title to have. So, who's Ron Mexico? Well, as we mentioned, it's HBC 438, so we'll kind of interchange that terminology a bit throughout the presentation. Jason was alluding to, in 2007, We were doing what's one of my favorite things is, oh, by the way, the beer's coming out, so enjoy. My favorite thing to do is during harvest to walk out into the field with Jason and go through the single hill plots. It's literally like they're dioecious plants, so there's males and females, as Jason mentioned. And so you're in a field of a bunch of children, and everyone has a different personality, different traits.
You mentioned that that's Ronnie Jr.
Oh, the beer that's pouring is Ronnie Jr., so we made two batches. Vinny brewed up the big batch, which we'll serve next, which is also the commemorative beer, and then Ronnie Jr. we did on a pilot, more of a homebrew scale, since we're releasing this hop is a homebrew hop. So anyway, walking through the fields, you can just grab a handful of hops from a plant, tear open the cone, rub it. If it smells great, throw some in the bag, take home, brew with it that day, make a fresh hop ale. If it smells garlicky, something you don't like, just toss it and move on to the next thing. So it's just a really interesting thing to be able to do, see all these different hop varieties, and they're out there. So Jason showed us 438, and my buddy Derry, who, Derry, where are you at? You're in the crowd somewhere here.
I'm out here, man.
Right on, man. Derry taught me to brew. He's a man. So anyway, we took some home, brewed with it, and just made a phenomenal beer, brought Jason some samples, and he was pretty excited about it. And so it's something that we continued to brew with. We did a lot of trials, and we're getting pretty good results out of it. So it continued from there. Here's a recipe that I'm sure you can get these electronically, so I'm not going to go into detail with it. But I like to do just a real simple single hop recipe, and Vinny's going to talk about his too. But it's basically just malt extract. I got a 60, a 15 minute, a 2 minute addition at end of boil, and then dry hop the heck out of it. And the goal is to make a pretty light colored beer that has good supporting body. And the beer you've got here is a similar recipe. But this is a recipe that we had some pretty good results with, ended up getting into GABF Pro-Am category. So Ron Mexico was starting down the road of becoming a variety someday. Here's a picture out at, Jason alluded to, Chuck Zimmerman. So the research center is named after Chuck. And we have a wolf picker out there. And the beauty of that is wolf pickers are German machines designed for small family hop farms that maybe have just a couple acres. So it does a nice job of actually taking an individual vine, and they've done some tweaks to it so they can collect the fresh harvested cones off of one vine, because that's what we're dealing with, a single hill. And it's called a single hill because that's kind of how the plant is grown, and it's just one plant at that point in time when we're talking about the single hill. And Vinny's made the effort to actually make a single hop variety, a beer called Row 2 Hill 56, which is the exact location the single plant of Simcoe came from, which is one of my favorite beers. Simcoe is one of my favorite varieties. So that's what we're talking about at this point. Still up till 2013, it was a single hill. There actually was a second hill, planted one in the backyard. So that was a way to pick some and brew with it right away and make a fresh hop ale. You know, everybody here's into home brewing. It's kind of fun to grow the hops too. You get to see how they're progressing throughout the year, and then the picking part's not all that much fun. But that's when you need to have some friends over for a beer and get them to pick the hops for you. So if you're going to make the effort to grow some hops, you might as well make a fresh hop ale, because that's the best way to. It's my favorite style of beer. Absolutely wonderful. And you can see the picture on the left, that's just the aroma addition. So that's a 5 gallon brew kettle there, just brewing on the stove at home. And that's a 1 pound wet hop addition. And then the picture on the right, you can see all the wet hops that are being used to dry hop with. So the rule of thumb is use 5 times the weight you would normally use. So take a regular hoppy IPA recipe you like, use 5 times the hops for wet hops, divide the alpha by 5 if you're using some brewing software, because it's just water, there's a lot of water weight in there, but there's all these delicate aromatic properties that are captured in a wet hop that you can't otherwise get. So it's just a wonderful thing. I love it. So here's the fresh hop recipe, kind of showing just the amounts that go in there. This is the version actually from 2013. So this was more of a session one. But when making the double IPA, that's that picture where you saw a whole pound of hops going in just for one hop addition. And I do recommend that you, if you're not using brewing software, it's a great thing having that history of recipes you made. And then I like making my own recipes. It's really simple to sit down, figure out what hops you're going to add, you know, what style you want. It's going to give you style guidelines. It's a really effective way to, I think, improve your brewing. So I totally recommend that. So 2013, it's Ron Mexico is starting to get bigger. We've got an acre planted out of Prault Farms, and it had some pretty good results at the Fresh Hop Ale Festival. I have to put in a shameless plug for the festival in Yakima. It's always the last or the first Saturday of October, and we had about 5,000 people last year and a lot of really damn good beer, and it's a great time. And then after the Fresh Hop Festival, this is something else that, you know, the passion for brewing, the passion for hops. This is something fun that we do every year just in the basement. We get all our friends together who made a fresh hop ale, and we go ahead and do a blind tasting and see what kind of flavors and aromas that everybody else got, because it's a seasonal beer. It's a one-of-a-kind beer. They're impossible to duplicate because you're brewing. You don't have any idea what the results are other than you're picking it and smelling it to see if it was ready to be harvested. And so that's it's a good time. I think that's what home brewing is all about. And then if your basement floods and you got to go down to your buddy's house and brew out on his stove, because my house was a mess, so this year we were, brewing outside. And here's a picture of that first acre of 438. It's a beautiful field. The picture doesn't really do it justice, but it is a beautiful-looking hop, and just nice, big, juicy, plump green cones you can see in those previous pictures. So you're probably still wondering, who is Ron Mexico, really? Well, obviously it's a beer made by Russian River. It's taken an unusual path from that single hill to becoming commercially available. I think that's one of the cool things about this hop is normally it's being offered to the big guys. And this one's different. You get to brew with it first. So we will be handing out samples. So thought you might enjoy that, and the beer, I hope. Which, by the way, I hope everyone's got a glass by now, but cheers. Cheers. And one interesting thing about Ron Mexico, you can't put it on an NFL jersey. The NFL will not allow that. I learned this listening to the Bob and Tom show one morning. I don't know if any of you are familiar with Bob and Tom, but they're a comedy, just morning DJ show out of Indianapolis. And I grew up listening to those, which is probably why I've got a little bit of a warped sense of humor. But their sports guy tried to order a Ron Mexico jersey, and then they quickly informed him that wasn't allowed. I'll let you figure out why. And then, of course, as Jason mentioned, it's a half Nea Mexicana, so the nickname just kind of stuck, and Derry and Jason and I have affectionately referred to it as Ron Mexico for years. So a little data on the hop from when we're receiving it into the warehouses at Yakima Chief Hop Union. As Jason mentioned, it's a very high alpha hop. It's a great aroma hop because it has that high hop oil as well, so it makes for a really good single hop beer. Some hops won't stand alone, but it does make for a good single hop beer. Ronnie Jr. that you're drinking actually has Cascade and Simcoe in it, and that's one thing we found is that those three hops play together really well. So it does stand on its own well, but it does work well with other hops. So these little packages, if we were to stick 1 ounce at a time into a bag manually, it would take quite a bit of time. So we have what we call a vertical form fill and seal machine. So we open 22-pound bags, enter those into a hopper, it goes through a conveyor, and then there's automatic scales that'll weigh out 1 ounce at a time, and then the bag is formed and sealed and made right there on the machine, so we can kick out quite a few. So doing 1 ounce at a time is a lot of little bags. Here's the recipe for Ronnie Jr. As I mentioned, it's got Cascade and Simcoe in it as well. Here's the stats on it. Ronnie Jr. did ferment out pretty dry. Alcohol is about 6.5%, colors 8.5%, IBUs about 71. It's got some bitterness to it, but I think Ronnie gives you a pretty nice clean bitterness, which is another great attribute of the hop. And I just want to mention some acknowledgments. Obviously, Jason and Select Botanicals, the work we've done. I do this home brewing thing on the side, so it's not like it's even part of my job, but it's just we are pretty passionate about what we do, so it's take a lot of enjoyment in that. Being able to take a walk through the breeding program and seeing the single hills is a true privilege. And then, of course, to Russian River, Vinny and Natalie were great hosts, had us down to brew Ron Mexico. And then, of course, Eric, he's the pub brewer down there, and he was great to work with on this project. Yakima Chief Hop Union, my company affords the opportunities to do these kinds of things and work in hops, which is greatly appreciated. My wonderful wife, Carol, she went down to Russian River with us, and she puts up with my hobby, which is also my career, and all of the above is pretty time-consuming, so... But it's a big part of what we do. So acknowledgments to her. And then, of course, to Derry. He's the guy who taught me how to brew. So cheers, man. And now I'm going to turn it over to Vinny. So enjoy the hop. Enjoy the beer.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about the actual brewing with single hops. Before I jump into my probably 10-minute presentation, I just want to make a couple comments based on some stuff that Jason said. First off, the whole 10-year thing. The hop that I like to talk about is Simcoe when you think about 10 years. So I was an early user of Simcoe in the early years of Russian River. 1998 or so, I was using it in its experimental form called YCR-014. And that was back when everything was YCR, which stood for Yakima Chief Research. So if you think about that, they started getting samples out to brewers in the experimental form in the, you know, call it the late 90s, that actually started in the late 80s, maybe early 90s at the, you know, soonest. And you think about when the IPA revolution started, which was, let's call that, you know, although I've been brewing IPAs, you know, up in Temecula since 94 commercially when I started. But really, IPAs only took hold in the last 5 years. So, you know, a lot of what we owe to the IPA revolution is to people like Jason who are breeding these hops, and they're so far ahead of the game. I mean, he has some crazy stuff growing out in the field, and every harvest when Natalie and I go up for hop selection, one of our favorite things is having dinner with Jason and his family, and after a few beers, we'll go out into the single hill plot, sometimes under the moonlight, if it's the right evening, and just go out there and start rubbing hops, and he's got this whole thing plotted out. But think about just how long it takes. And then secondly, I was thinking too, there's great pictures of hop and growing and harvest and whatnot that these guys had, both Jason and Carl. But nothing beats being there. And so a hop union has a hop school. And the first week is, the first session is for professional brewers, but then they do one for home brewers. So it's worth getting up there and checking out. Yakima, that time of year, is a pretty lively place. There's brewers everywhere from all over the country in town, and it's just really neat to see the process. Mike and Cheryl Smith are in here somewhere from Loftus Ranches, and you often get to go to their farm. Jason and his family have tried to one-up the Smiths with their new facility. I call their new picking hall the Taj Mahal of pickers. It's pretty crazy. And then some other things that I was thinking about when Jason was talking was, you know, he's not just looking for aroma hops. I know for the last
decade or so, Jason's been looking for a high alpha hop. And when you think about it, you say, well, why would a hop breeder, you know, especially now when IPAs are everything and really all we need is aroma hops, why would someone want high alpha hops? Well, if they can find an even higher alpha hop that the industry can jump onto, that means that there's more alpha acid out there, and that means that they can have less acreage of high alpha hops because they're getting more out of every acre, and then that opens up more acreage for more aroma hops, for more high oil hops. So they're not just looking for specifically, you know, for the high alpha or for the oil high oil hops. And then the last thing that I thought was interesting, I just took a trip to Yakima with a couple of brewer friends from Belgium, and one of the interesting things that we got to do on this trip was really spend a lot more time than we normally do with the hop growers. So something that Jason's looking for now is an early harvest hop, which I think is fascinating, trying to widen that picking window. I heard at the end of Mitch's talk just before here, he was talking about, you know, how hops are being laid on top of each other, and it's getting harder and harder as more varieties come out. How do the growers pick, you know, what, you know, they have to decide when they're going to pick, and everything's laid on top of each other. So to try to widen that picking window, they need to breed for some earlier harvested hops. So pretty interesting stuff. So I'm going to talk a little about how I got into brewing single hop beers, why I brew them, and then talk about the beer itself. Before I get into the hop two at our single hop beer, which is the base for most of our single hop beers, I just want to make sure you understand the cool factor that you guys are all going to get this hop before craft brewers get it. Aside from the batch that we brewed for the commemorative beer, that will be the only commercial beer brewed with this hop for whatever amount of time until the hop will most likely become commercialized for professional brewers. But right now, you guys are the only ones that are going to get it. And there is just something inherently very cool about that. It's probably the first time it's ever been done. And Jason pitched this idea to me probably 3, 4, 5 years ago when I was up there for selection. And we laid this plan out to have them get more acreage in the ground and then do these little 1 ounce packs and do this presentation. And then we had to wait for the AHA conference to be in the right city where we had distribution, where we could brew it, easily get it down here. So it all kind of came together this year. But don't let that get lost in this whole thing, because I've been on the forefront of brewing with a lot of new varieties. Simcoe back in the early days. Jason mentioned Mosaic when it was 369. Around our brewery, we don't call it Mosaic. It's still 369. Equinox around our brewery is still 366. So we've been very fortunate to be on the forefront, and I just can't emphasize enough how cool it is that you guys are going to get this opportunity. So back in the early days of Russian River, I started brewing this beer, Hop 2, it's single hop beer. I started brewing with every variety I could get. I went old school, went with Bromling Cross and Bullion and Brewer's Gold and a lot of these varieties, Eroica, they don't even exist anymore. But I wanted to know about every hop, and I wanted to taste it in its single format. And I think that's something that whether you're a professional or a home brewer, you really can gain a lot and learn a lot about a hop by brewing with a single hop beer. And so the journey began, and then I rolled into more modern varieties, Cascade, Centennial, CTZ, Chinook, and then came all the one-off experimental hops from YCR through our salesman, Gerard Lemons, who was, for me, probably the one person that taught me the most about hops. People ask me all the time, so, you know, how is it that you became so good at making IPAs? And I think all the single hop beers is really the reason, because you learn the nuances of it. That's the benefit of brewing a single hop beer. I was getting these samples from Gerard, and little did I know that they were actually coming from Jason. We didn't know each other at the time, but these samples would come through, and I'd hear about this young breeder working with Chuck Zimmerman. I think Jason would hear a little bit about some brewer down in Sonoma County brewing with the one-off hops that they were breeding, and so we started seeing all the benefits from it. The pitfalls is that oftentimes a single hop beer is one-dimensional. One of the biggest things that you can learn from a single hop beer is, you know, what's its bittering value? If you believe in a high cohumulon hop gives you a harsh bitterness, it's still nice to see that in, even though you may see it on paper, it's still nice to see it in the actual beer. So that's a benefit, but it's also a pitfall because you end up with this potentially very harsh bitterness. We just did a single hop brew for another farm with a new hop called Idaho Number 7, and it was extremely harsh and astringent, but had a really nice, pleasant flavor, aroma. So we're now using that hop in some other low-gravity session hoppy beers, but we just won't use it as a bittering hop anymore. Amarillo was the same way. I used Amarillo in its early days back in the late 90s, and it too was incredibly harsh. I remember just going, God, this is one of the worst bitternesses that I've ever tasted in a beer, and yet it had this really nice, pleasant aroma and flavor. So it's actually a great club project for, you know, everyone to get together, use the same recipe, brew same recipe with just different single hop varieties. So the idea behind Hop to It is same malt bill every time, same hop additions. I'm going to work backwards. So same dry hop quantities, same end to boil addition, same mid boil quantity, and then the only variable is the hop variety itself and the quantity of the first hop addition. And you're going to make that adjustment for BUs to hit the same bittering units. We've gone so far as that Jason uses the same recipe we use for the most part when we're doing single hop beers. So there's a lot of benefit that we're both getting from it, the brewer and the growers. So on to the beer itself, Ron Mexico. For this, I wanted to make something lower in alcohol. So we took our single hop to it recipe and made a slight deviation of it, brought the gravity down. I'll bring the slide up for the recipe itself. So it's 11.2 starting Play-Doh gravity, finishes just below 3. We've got 4.5% alcohol, and then BUs, 57 BUs. This is actually measured in our lab, so it's an analytical number. There's the recipe itself. Again, this will probably be available electronically if you're interested. At the end of the slide presentation, my email will be up there. I can always email it to you as well. But if you look at it, very little crystal malt, a little bit of acidulated malt for pH adjustment. When you're making these low-gravity session beers, typically you need some carapils, some unfermentable malt, just to give you a body and mouthfeel. Be careful when you're using carapils, though, because if you use too much, it leaves kind of a thick, sweet character in the mouthfeel. And for us, one of the things that we saw over the years as we become better brewers at Russian River, which really means we become better yeast wranglers, is that our viability of our yeast is now typically 95 to 98% when we're pitching it, so it's incredibly strong. We're mashing now up at 156 to 158 for most of our beers that end up at 2.5 Play-Doh. We've gone to the highest end of the mash, of temperature scale, that for a beer like this or a Dribble Belts, another session beer we make, we have to use some carapils or else we're going to be into the 160s and we'll be killing the enzymes in the mash. So just by having super strong, vibrant yeast has made our beers dry out more. And so that's something to keep in mind in homebrewers and homebrewing in general, that it may not be, your beers may be able to get drier. It's just that your yeast doesn't have high viability. You may be having a strong pitch, the right pitch rate, but you end up with a beer that stalls out. We found that as we became better yeast handlers. Notice on the hop bill how much of the BUs are coming from the final hop addition. A ton of BUs are coming from the from that last hop addition. We did this on purpose, though, and it's a pretty popular thing in craft brewing now is to backload the recipe with just a load of hops, and you're going to carry a ton of bitterness through. It's the one fault of every brewing software out there. I haven't seen one yet that calculates BUs on the end of boil hop addition. And if you let's talk that through for just a second before we get to questions. Let's say so we end the boil at our brewery, and then we have to do about a 5-minute rest just to let the worts settle down. Then we'll whirlpool. If it's at our production brewery, it's 10 minutes. So we let it sit for 5 minutes. It's 10 minutes to pump it to the whirlpool. That's 15 minutes. We'll give it 20 minutes to rest. That's 35 minutes. And then it's going to take 30 to 40 minutes to pump the wort from the whirlpool to the, through the heat exchanger to the fermenter. So that means the very last bit of wort that goes through will have been in contact with that final hop addition for more than an hour at pretty elevated temperatures. That's what brewing software almost never calculates in, is that you pick up a ton of bitterness from that final addition. So don't underestimate how much you get from that. So you can look at the process there. One of the things that we did a little different on this was we gave it a longer rest between finishing fermentation and when we dry hopped it. That was to get as much yeast to fall out as possible. One thing that we found is that 5 PSI top pressure on a fermenter will help push a lot of yeast into the cone of the tank. We can remove the yeast, dry hop. By doing that, we have more contact, more surface area between the hops and the beer itself. So the availability of the 438, these are a few places that that will have it, or distribution. And then the one cool thing about this project is all the money from all the profits from the 438 hop are going to go to a program that Mike and Cheryl Smith from Loftus Ranch has started a few years ago called Ales for ALS. And this is going to raise over $100,000 for Ales for ALS, which would be a cool component of it. And if you want the recipe, feel free to email me. I'll shoot you the recipe in a PDF. And if there's any questions, we'll use the mic in the middle. And three of us are happy to answer any questions that you have.
Jason, if this is a wild Mexican hop, it has a different light cycle than we have up in Yakima.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, that's right. This plant came from, I don't know for sure where it came from. We always, I'm assuming it came from the southwestern United States rather than actually in Mexico. We kind of decomposed the Neo-Mexicanus name. But with that said, part of the reason it grew so vigorously and flowered so late was the fact that it had a different response to day, to daylight.
Thank you. So I have a question on the hop growing distributing side. With proprietary hop varieties, how much licensing is going on in the industry, i.e. Citra, Simcoe, Amarillo?
How much licensing is
licensing going on? Between like whoever gets it in the first place, or whoever breeds it, and then licenses it to other farms. How much is that happening to grow the proprietary hops?
It's increasingly the model in hops, and we found that with the popularity of IPAs and the way these hops have blown up, those proprietary hops are being licensed to just about every grower out there now. We really had no choice but to open that up like that. And so I would venture to guess a variety like Simcoe probably has more exposure across the industry than maybe even Cascade at this point in terms of the number of growers growing it.
Cool. Thank you.
I want to add to that, too. As a brewer, we're looking for growers and new varieties that aren't just being grown at one farm. There's been some varieties over the years that have been held back to just one farm that maybe owned that variety as proprietary variety, and it's become an issue for supply. So we, as brewers, we're happy to see, whether it's a private variety or a public variety, we want to see more people, more farms growing it so that it's not just one farm, and if there's a catastrophe, the whole crop's gone.
So you were saying when you do the single hop pale ales, you notice that like Amarillo had a really harsh bitterness. So aside from alpha acid, what's one of the most, or something you've noticed is good to look at that will really determine what type of bitterness a hop would give you?
You know, I'm Jason skipped over it because it is a controversial topic, but the CoH or cohumulone, which is an indicator of or can be an indicator of cleaner, harsh bitterness. It's one of the reasons why, and I think when you tasted the Ron Mexico here, we'll have it on tap tonight at the commemorative beer booth, and then you all got a bottle too. You'll see how you tasted how clean of a bitterness it is. That was, I think Jason said it was 20 to 25. That's pretty low. There aren't too many hops that are lower than that. Horizon, Crystal, those are hops that have a lower. Simcoe is really low too. It's what makes Simcoe a good single hop beer in our Road to Hill 56. So that's a number that I look at. That was something that Gerard taught me. You know, one of Jason's former co-workers and my former sales guy from Yakima Chief. So that is a number that I look at, and it's something I believe that is a good indicator. And if you get up, you know, into the 30s, you're going to start getting harsher bitterness qualities.
Yeah, I've heard that it was kind of debatable as if it did or didn't, but I've kind of noticed the same. So if I say I order hops, I could email somebody to get that number maybe, because they usually put alpha and beta, but
yeah,
getting
go,
that code.
I don't know if it's on the, I know Carl knows, is all that stuff on the Hop Union
it's
website?
It's not usually on the bags, but.
Yeah, it's not on the bag, but if you go to the website or the variety book, it will have cohumulone content on it. And, you know, it is a debated subject. I've seen some really good presentations that say, yeah, low CoH is better. I've seen others that say the opposite. So it is a personal preference, but there's a lot more than a myth to it, because it is commonly believed that high CoH means harsh bitterness. But brewing technique and style and how you use the hop definitely plays into it.
All right, cool.
Also check out USA. I think it's usahops.com. It's, yep, American Hop Growers. .org, USAHops.org. They've got a ton of information on hops. I think pretty much every variety has its own page with a lot more specs than you would see on a bag or a box.
And it's all consistent enough.
It's consistent enough that once you learn what the range is for the variety, that's how you can make your decision. It's not something you have to have an analysis on every lot of hops that comes through.
All right, cool. Thank you very much.
Hi. Awesome beer. Thank you. Vinny, how do you feel about hop bursting as opposed to doing a long hop stand at the end?
Hop what?
Hop bursting. Like, say, 20 minutes left, you just start hammering it with hops over and over till the end of the boil.
You know, I mean, it's just like anything in brewing, whether it's professional or home brewing. It's the cool thing about home brewing is you're brewing beer for yourself. And, you know, professionally too, you know, at the end of the day, let's face it, craft brewers make beer that they like to drink, and thank God all the consumers are going along with it. So, you know, I think it's what makes the craft beer industry so exciting, is that all the different techniques, you know, are different from brewery to brewery, whether it's how you add hops. You know, I mean, I think about back when I was at Blind Pig, we would gain all of our bitterness on the front end. Mm-hmm. And for a beer like Pliny, okay, we still are getting a lot. But for a beer like Ron Mexico, you know, you saw the numbers. That's all coming from the end of boil. So, you know, the techniques is the artistic side of this.
You know. Cool. Thank you.
Yeah.
Go Hawks.
Yeah, nice shirt, by the way.
Hey, thanks for the talk. If you're curious about cohumulone, there was a talk last year by the experimental brewer at Green Man. I think he's moved on, but if you go on the AHA, you know, website, you can listen to that talk on cohumulone. It's pretty cool, really kind of crazy. especially tasting the beer. But anyway, I was going to ask about the double dry hopping on the Ron Mexico. I'm wondering if, like, as a home brewer, if that's even, like, if that's something we should really pursue as home brewers, or if that's something that mainly is effective as a in commercial brewing, or if there's a technique that you think makes that, you know, more applicable in one versus the other or whatever.
Yeah, so the question was about double dry hopping. You know, the reason I've been doing it back since the Blind Pig days up in Temecula, the basic reason I always did it was the idea was that if you add one lump sum of hops, let's say we're dry hopping at 2 pounds per barrel, and you add the 2 pounds per barrel dry hop, they're all falling at the same time. The idea of double dry hopping is to take that 2 pounds per barrel, split it in half, or whatever proportion you want, you know, that's the artistic side, and you have the first, say, pound per barrel settle, and then a couple days later come back, and so that smaller amounts, but in contact with the beer twice, and so you're really getting more surface area instead of all of the hops falling at the same time. I think that you get more hop aroma. It's obviously again it's the artistic side, but we've just always had good results with it. I know Jeremy at Lagunitas thinks it's crap, and he just still does one dry hop addition for simplicity. But you know, for me, it's just something that we do. It's a part of our technique. It's not right or wrong either way. I think as professional brewers, though, we have to be careful to not just make knee-jerk reactions and start changing our recipes. So, for instance, you know, OSU has done a ton of research that if you recirc and mix your tank, you can get a much quicker extraction and thus turn your tank faster. We're not about to fuck around with Pliny the Elder, so we still dry hop. We still dry hop a pretty long period of time, and it's a part of, I think, what makes our beers what they are, you know? And again, no answer right or wrong, but we're not about to start making major changes to something that's been really good to us.
Do you think that's temperature dependent? I've had a lot of my dry hops just float on top, so I was kind of wondering if that may impact it as well.
A lot of problem is pellet density as well that you're dealing with. One of the things that the hop processors, and Carl could speak to this a lot better than me, but they're really, take when you open up your samples, you can actually take these hops and break them up, and whereas some hops are just hard as a rock. One good thing I think every brewer should have is just a small pestle and mortar in your brewery, and they're great for breaking up hop pellets. You can smell them and whatnot, but if your hops are just floating at the top, I think given time they will sink. They'll get hydrated enough, but yeah, I mean you're probably dealing with a density issue there. Was there another question, or was that it?
I can add two tips for that. One is if you're just fermenting in a 5-6 gallon glass carboy, I stir them every morning, just shake it, and every evening, and that adds to that contact time, so that helps. And then crash the beer. So any hops that are floating, I just stick the carboy in my fridge, and within a day, they'll all fall. And they generally go down pretty slow, and I think it also helps to clarify the beer, so any proteins that are out there can kind of snatch those up.
And one other thing with on that is tank geometry has such an important component on dry hopping, and it is effective. It's the same thing for home brewing. If I was back home brewing, I would only dry hop in tall, skinny Cornelius type kegs. Tall, skinny, more travel time, so there's more contact time, as opposed to a squattier, fat tank that has a wider surface area, but when the hops fall through, say it's a shallower depth that they have to fall through, you would think that when they hit the bottom, that you would then have them sitting in the bottom of the vessel with more surface area contact, but the problem is they're most likely sitting in yeast that's settled too, and so you don't have any contact. We've done analytical work in our lab or sent beers out, and we've shown that a wide, fat tank has lower oil and less aroma than a tall, skinny tank. The best dry hop beers that we make comes from Fermenter 8 at our pub. It's a tall, skinny tank. And in fact, I think I think we just brewed the last batch of Janus Brown Ale. Tasty's up front here. I think we brewed it in fermenter 8 at the pub, the last one, and it hands down had the best aroma we've ever had on the commercial batch of Janus Brown. Same recipe as in the past, just tall and skinny. So I think we're out of time, but for those questions that are still hanging, we'll be up front for a little bit, or we can meet you in back. And then I'll be at my booth tonight pouring beer if you want to come by if there's any other questions.
There we go. All right.